If you look across all the major metro areas in the US, like apart from three of them, they've all had record high rents in the last two quarters of this year. And that's something that doesn't look like it's going to slow down. And the problem with rental increases like that is they may level off after a while, but they never come back down as quickly as they've gone up. And so you get this point where rents shoot up and then they plateau and then they go up again from there. You never really see rents fall that much. And one of the big issues with that is we're now finding people telling us that they're sort of worried about moving. People are turning down like career opportunities. People are turning down life opportunities because they're worried about the cost of rent. And that's not how housing should work. That's not what it's for. Housing should be there as a safe, comfortable, secure space that we all then go and use as a platform to live whatever version of a productive life we want. And at the moment, housing has become a real sort of hindrance for people, I think.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lanphier, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Matt Hutchinson. Matt is the communications director at Spare Room. Spare Room is now the world's leading flatshare site. Since 2004, Spare Room has helped over 14 million people in the UK and US find homes. Our discussion touches on the housing crisis, changing demographics of those seeking shared living arrangements, and cultural shifts towards co-living. It's well worth a listen. Matt, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
Hey, nice to meet you.
So why Spare Rooms? Why Auxiliary Real Estate? What got you interested?
It's a gap that we sort of spotted in the UK, really. That's where this all started. You know, just going back to the end of the 90s, early 2000s, how hard it was to find places to live. You know, people were putting notes up in shop windows, people were advertising in local newspapers. And by the time you saw those ads, like the room had probably gone and you'd be in the phone box phoning people and just trying to desperately go and see places. And most of what we do was coming online around that time. And we just thought, you know, it's a good thing to do is to put this as a web thing, because everything's in real time. There's access to much more information. And that's what people needed.
Do you think this kind of falls into the broader housing crisis? Because it seems like, I mean, I'm sitting on panels, I'm working with all sorts of communities in this area. There seems to be a real housing crisis beyond even looking at the data. Everybody you talk to that's my age or younger, I'm a, you know, peak millennial, struggling to find housing. Are you seeing that in the UK as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of scary how similar the patterns are in the UK and the US, even though the markets are very different and we have different sort of attitudes to home ownership and things like that. Actually, renters are struggling and rents are at record highs across the UK and the US.
And so what do you think is contributing to this?
I think there's a lot of factors. I think particularly in the UK, we don't build enough houses anymore. But in the US, you know, there's so many different challenges, including just the amount of existing stock that has gone to things like Airbnb and holiday lets. And you think of that as being like a problem maybe in some of the more rural places, but actually in cities now, and cities are starting to do something about this. You know, they're realizing that so many apartments are being let out to travelers where they used to be residential. And so there's just a lack of supply all round, but that really isn't helping.
So how does your platform, and go into a little bit more depth in how it works, kind of work to solve some of this crisis?
It's really simple. It's just a solution for people who have space they need to fill and people looking for somewhere to live, to meet each other, interact, and kind of that's it. It's not anything more than an introduction service, really, because that's what people need. The most important thing when you're living with people is people. And if you look through a bunch of listings, you know, it's going to be a bed and a wardrobe and a chest of drawers in a bedroom. And that's fine. And the amenities are interesting and how much it costs is important and the area is important. But actually, the key thing is who you're going to be spending the next 12 months living with. So it actually allows people to put some information about themselves, like what they're looking for, what kind of person they are, what kind of sharing situation they're looking for, because that's what's going to make the difference in the long term.
And can you dive into that a little bit more? What are people looking for typically in a roommate?
So the things that come up over and over again are sort of similar approaches to cleanliness, similar sort of values, and similar kind of approaches to what kind of shared apartment they're looking for. And I think that's the key thing. People say, like so-and-so is the ideal roommate, but there's no such thing really. My ideal roommate and yours might be totally different. I talked to somebody yesterday who was saying, like, my roommate's amazing. We cook together, we eat together, we have a glass of wine and watch a box set together. And I talked to somebody the same day who said, like, my roommate's brilliant. I never see him. And you know, and the, both of those are equally valid ways to want to live. I mean, we would definitely come down on the side of interacting with your roommates because it can be a brilliant experience. But some people just don't want that. And so it's knowing what you want that's the thing.
So how did Spare Room kind of address the crisis in a way that by connecting people? Do you think connection is really what the key driver is, or is the driver something else?
So I think connection is really important. Like, people come, however we would like to brand it as Spare Room being all about wonderful shared experiences, the real driver is people come to us looking for accommodation in a certain location at a certain budget. That's what brings them in. But our job is to kind of sell the benefits of sharing and explain how great it can be. If you meet three people and share an apartment, if you meet the right three people, it can change your life and it can be the best year you've ever had. And if you don't, it can be a really tricky year. And, you know, our job is to make sure people have the good years.
So who are the folks using Spare Room? I like to imagine that it's like Friends, you know, the show in New York. Everyone's coming in. It's a lot of younger kind of hip people. Is that who your user base predominantly is?
I mean, our user base would be delighted if they lived in apartments that nice. But yes, it's exactly what you'd imagine in terms of 20s and 30s sort of young professionals. But the interesting thing is, there's a big chunk of roommates that are older than that as well. And although the core market is 20s, 30s, actually the over 50s are the fastest growing bit of the market. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. I think just some people are renting and sharing for longer because, as you say, there's a housing crisis. And it's not just like a housing crisis in terms of housing being available. It's an affordability crisis. That's the main thing, is that even when there is stuff available, people being able to afford these ever-increasing rents is so difficult. So there's kind of lifetime renters and lifetime roommates on one side of that. But on the other side, there's people maybe coming out of a job change, you know, long-term relationship, and looking around to rent a studio or a one bed and seeing how much that's going to cost them and just going, well, there's no way I can do that. I just can't afford to do that. So they're ending up like in an apartment share, maybe for the first time in their life, in their 50s or even 60s.
So why do you think that demographic, that over 50 demographic, is growing so quickly? Do you think there are societal factors involved, or is it just what you mentioned?
I think it's affordability. I think that's the key thing to all of this is, you know, if you look across all the major metro areas in the US, like apart from three of them, they've all had record high rents in the last two quarters of this year. And that's, you know, that's something that doesn't look like is going to slow down. And the problem with rental increases like that is they may level off after a while, but they never come back down as quickly as they've gone up. And so you get this point where rents shoot up and then they plateau and then they go up again from there. You never really see rents fall that much. There was a bit of that during the pandemic, just because there were so many empty rooms and people weren't able to move. But largely rents go up and rents keep going up. And the fact that we're in a position maybe 4 or 5 years ago where we looked at rents across the US and went, well, like realistically, how much higher can they go? And they've gone higher. And they've gone higher again. And, you know, that's the problem. And one of the big issues with that is we're now finding people telling us that they're sort of worried about moving because they don't want to, you know, they might have been somewhere for 2 or 3 years, their rent's not gone up, and they look at a similar sort of space and it might be costing them $300-$500 a month more. And so people go, well, I can't afford that and I don't want that stress. But then people are turning down job offers, people are turning down like career opportunities, people are turning down life opportunities because they're worried about the cost of rent. And that's not how housing should work. That's not what it's for. Housing should be there as a safe, comfortable, secure space that we all then go and use as a platform to live whatever version of a productive life we want. And at the moment, housing has become a real sort of hindrance for people, I think.
Yeah, I talk to Fortune 500 folks all day long about the issues that they're having with their labor supply, and the biggest driver of all is housing, right?
Yep.
I think for anybody who's interested in societal development, cultural growth, and economic well-being for everyone, having that base is absolutely necessary. I'm curious, have you seen any corporate involvement in your platform, or is it predominantly just individuals meeting individuals?
It's individuals meeting individuals. There are also kind of, you know, landlords and brokers who get involved. And also what we're seeing more is the rise of the kind of built-to-rent model and the co-live spaces or the purpose-built blocks for apartments that are built not to sell but to hold on to and rent out. And that's definitely increased. And we've seen sort of rumblings occasionally of corporates talking about investing in housing just so they have somewhere to put people. Because, you know, post-pandemic, we have this interesting scenario where in theory, a lot of people can live anywhere. Like, people don't necessarily need to live in the major metro areas anymore because there's so much remote working. But all of the big employers that, you know, hospitals, universities, the military, all these things, they're physical places you need to be, you know, and they employ a lot of people between them. And so I think some people think we've progressed to this point where living where you work is not necessarily important anymore. But actually, for so many people, it really is.
Yeah, I think the whole pandemic put this de-emphasis on situs, on the whole idea that you couldn't or you didn't need to go into work. And there is some truth to that. There, flexibility is important and hybrid work is important. But the where we live, for a variety of reasons, is essential, both on the workforce and the cultural level. I'm curious, what are you seeing in terms of who's using the platform and where in the world? Who's predominantly the most interested in using Spare Room?
I mean, it's predominantly young professionals living in major urban areas. That's always going to be the bulk of it. But the interesting thing we're starting to see, and it's been a thing we've had a lot of in the UK, and it's definitely happening in the US as well, is homeowners renting out a room to a roommate. And the interesting thing about that is that's sort of spread out all across the country in small towns and big towns. And because particularly in the last 2 or 3 years, you know, the cost of owning home has rocketed. People are worried about the cost of living on all fronts. And I think there's this sort of slight fallacy that once you buy a property, then you're sorted. And actually, buying a property is expensive. Getting the funds together is expensive. Maintaining that is expensive. And a lot of people are finding that rather than take a second job or look for a pay rise, renting out a room and getting somebody else in to help is actually one of the easiest solutions in many ways. And there are, you know, millions of empty rooms out there. People are, and have been for a long time, sort of encouraged to overconsume property. And there's lots of reasons why that makes sense for people. You invest your money in it, and it's a good place to keep your money. But it does also mean there's a lot of spare capacity out there, that if just a few percent of people rented out their spare rooms, you'd actually create capacity for, you know, a fairly major city spread out all over the country. So it's a really useful solution because it doesn't require a single brick to be laid. It uses capacity that is already out there, and it helps the people who are living in those homes afford them.
Yeah. We've had a substantial amount of discussion on this podcast about how builders tend to build to the max on every single site. And if a site can be constructed to be a 5-bedroom house, it's often in a builder's incentive to make it a 5-bedroom house, even though most people today don't have the family size and family structure that requires, you know, 5 bedrooms, right? So in terms of that, are you seeing that as a growing demographic in terms of use, both in the UK and US? Or do you think there's still a tremendous amount of room to grow in that regard?
No, I think there's definitely a lot of capacity for that. And it is, I think sometimes our attitudes to what home is lag slightly behind the way we use property. You know, people are very attached to like houses that look traditional and this classic sort of idea of a storybook house. And actually, for a lot of people, a modern build 2 or 3 bed apartment is going to be far better for their needs and far easier to run and far better insulated and all of those things. But we have romantic notions about home, I think, sometimes. And people do want a house with a yard and all of that thing. And so it's interesting how kind of cultural expectations play into this a little bit as well. And particularly in the UK, I think maybe not so much in the US, but the UK sort of prides itself on being a nation of homeowners. We have this phrase in Englishman's home is his castle. And it's sort of ground into you that if you don't buy a home, you've somehow failed. And so young renters in the UK have this huge burden of guilt as well as this huge burden of affordability. And I don't get the sense that that is quite the same in the US. There's a lower rate of home ownership in the major cities than there is in London, for example. But having your own space and kind of being able to live life the way you want is really important to people. And I think if people have bought a two-bed apartment and they're living out on their own, you can rent it out, get a roommate in, make some money. If you don't want to give up your privacy all the time, have somebody in when they move out, have a break. You know, it's just part of this flexible way we use our homes these days that reflect modern living.
So talking about those cultural expectations within the home, what are you seeing within your users, how they perceive the relationship in terms of, you know, things like privacy? I know many people who have considered renting out a home, but they are scared to lose that privacy. What are you seeing in terms of how people perceive just expectations of co-living?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I think that is a cultural thing that I think since the 80s and 90s, we've all been conditioned slightly to think about like being self-sufficient and being individuals and, you know, this kind of collective idea that we're all in it for ourselves and everybody's separate and everybody should do it. And actually, when it comes to living, I think there's a, I'd say you were talking about before about sort of post-pandemic and work, this idea that we can all just be completely separate and we can just all zoom into everything and that's fine. And it's true, but at the same time, going into an office or being around people is something that when you've experienced not being able to do that for a while, you realize just how important little interactions are and all that kind of thing. And so I think like you do lose some privacy if people move into your home. It's true, but you also gain a lot as well. And it's about choosing the right person. It's funny, I was talking to him about this the other day, and he'd ended up in a house that he intended to live in with his partner, and they'd separated and he was living out on his own. So he rented out a room, and he'd come home from work and look up and the light would be on in the kitchen, and he'd go, "Oh, they're in. I'm going to have to talk to them. This is awful." And after about 3 or 4 weeks of this, he'd come home and see the light on and go, "Brilliant. Somebody's in, somebody to talk to." Because he just kind of hadn't realized how lonely you can get living on your own. And I think particularly if you live in a city and you've maxed out your affordability on finding somewhere to live in like a studio or a one bed, and you can't really afford to go out and you're remote working and not seeing your colleagues, all of a sudden you can end up incredibly isolated, even in the middle of a, you know, city of 15 million people. And I've probably wandered off topic slightly there, but it's all those little touch points of connectivity and, you know, how we live both as individuals, but as communities, and that I think people are starting to value again.
No, I'd like to dive back into that. So in terms of what do you see folks valuing in terms of these micro connections? Are there particularly success stories that you think are driving the platform and the platform's usage?
I think it's important for us to show the range of success stories there are, actually, because I think that can be one of the things that people don't see. People think, like you were saying, you know, that the idea that apartment sharing is all like Friends. It is, but it's also like the Golden Girls, and it's also like you can name a sitcom and it is like that. And, you know, that it's amazing how many sitcoms take place in like rented apartments, because they're a great location for all of this stuff, because so much happens in them. There's so much life and so much interaction. And I think people would be amazed if they saw the range of ages of people who live together. You know, there are people in their 20s sharing with people in their 60s or 70s. There are people who have a house with, you know, their kids have maybe all left home and they've got a lot of space but not much income, and they're lonely and they just want a bit of company or some help around the house. And I think there's so many little success stories. Like, we hear all the time from people who met through Spare Room because they moved in together and ended up, you know, 10 years later getting married, and there are children that exist in the world because their parents met through a Spare Room ad. And all of those little connections that we don't necessarily see, but all of that, that's what I see as a success story. Like, rather than sort of the numbers or the growth or just like helping people have that kind of experience when they live together, is extraordinary. And we probably don't see most of that after the fact. But I think that's the sort of success stories that we love to hear about.
So beyond those cultural success stories, the economic success story has been often there's unused capital in the market. And I'm curious with that, what do you see in terms of individuals that are using homes? Are they using spare room almost entirely as independent kind of landlords, or are they using it primarily for that cultural connection?
I think the main driver is always going to be financial. I think all of these things, if you're renting out a room, if you're living in a shared apartment, like the main driver is going to be affordability. But it's all the other stuff that comes with it. And people, particularly the people who are homeowners and renting out a room, or people who live on their own and taking a roommate, you know, they are often a little bit reluctant at first. And it's, oh, I might lose my privacy, and what if it doesn't work? And we hear from so many people who've kind of gone, yeah, no, I was quite reluctant to do this, but actually thinking about it now, having done it a couple of times, I wouldn't live here on my own anymore, because things like company and things like being able to share the financial burden, but also like little things that you wouldn't think about, like having somebody to feed your cat while you're away, or knowing that when you're on holiday, your house isn't empty. Or some people even just saying that, you know, being alone in the house at night compared to knowing somebody else is sleeping down the hallway and just feeling safer at home. There's all these little benefits that aren't really the key drivers for people doing it, but they just add up to the sort of stories that we wouldn't have anticipated when we started doing this. We think about location and we think about budget and we think about all of that kind of stuff. But all these little human connections and all these little human touch points that we hear about, that's the fascinating side of it, I think.
Human touch points really do drive things, particularly as they build into networks. And I'm curious, in terms of that, have you seen the platform become a useful point in terms of networking connections? Is there a network within Spare Room of people that are having multiple Spare Room connections? Or is it typically just a one-off interaction?
Yeah, it's more about, so people tend to use Spare Room. It's one of the challenges of actually running a service like ours is people probably are only going to be in market for our service once a year, and we never know when it's going to be. And so they'll go through this intense period of 3 or 4 weeks of finding a roommate or finding a room, and then they sort of disappear from view for us for quite a while. But it's the connections that start. So we've heard stories of people who've met and ended up starting businesses together, and people who've kind of, you know, might have moved in with one person and then met their friends, which has become a whole new social network or a business network, or they met their partner through their roommate's friend. And it's that side of, you know, it's just, you're not just meeting one or two people, you're meeting one or two people, and then this whole Venn diagram opens up of overlapping stuff. And that's, you know, that's not unique to sharing housing with people. That's just the way life works. But we live in an age where so much of those connections happen through our phone screens and tapping on things and swiping on things. And I think people really find, you know, you look at things like dating, and the vast majority of relationships now start online, where they used to start through meeting the friends of your work colleagues or meeting your friends' friends. And it's just, I think people crave a bit of that again, sort of just more organic ways of connecting with people.
So talking about craving organic things, one of the things that we always like to crave is getting to our final four and learning a little bit more about you and a little bit more about how you view the world of real estate. So the first question, and one of my favorites, is where do you see real estate going 10 years from now?
You know, it's fascinating because we get so caught up in short-term thinking. And my sister-in-law works for a cathedral. And she has this phrase called cathedral thinking, which is like not what's going to happen this year or next quarter, or like what is the effects of what I do now going to be on this space in 100 years time. And it's extraordinary because nobody thinks like that anymore. And in some ways, in 10 years, very little could have changed, really, in the real estate market. You know, there might be new tech and new ways of dealing with things, but it may all be pretty much as it is. I suspect one thing that will change is that, like, not just in US cities and UK cities, but around the world, people will start to question whether using so much existing stock for short-term lets is the best way forward when residential, if things carry on the way they are, residential real estate is going to become thinner and thinner on the ground, and we will need it more and more. So I think that's a big conversation over the next 10 years. We might find ourselves in a very different place there than we are now.
Yeah, we've talked with several people who might come on the podcast soon, in New Orleans, as well as a number of other cities that have had major crises in terms of overusing, I would say, Airbnbs, and then had a step back in terms of how they apply it. Do you see that spare room as it comes into conflict with that, or do you think it's a platform that's an entirely different platform that'll be viewed that way by municipalities?
I certainly hope it's viewed differently, because we exclusively are looking for people to be able to live somewhere like as a residential long-term thing. We don't offer like lets of a day or a week, or that's just not what we do. It's about using space, and it's about kind of using housing better and using it more, but purely for residential. That's the important thing.
And then in terms of that, one of the things that we like to do, which we think is an important thing as well, is kind of take a step back in time. We have a lot of individuals on this podcast, smaller than the whole, you know, group that listen, but a lot that are under, I would say, under 35, and some of them are in their 20s and kind of trying to figure out their way in the real estate world. And I'm curious if you could give one little tidbit of advice, what would that be?
I think it's not to be afraid to trust your instincts. I think certainly when you're younger, you presume that everybody else knows and you don't. And that's true. I mean, when it comes to experience, like, you can't replace experience. But I think we all have our own ways of approaching stuff. And I think it's important to trust what you bring to it as well. Like, I look back on the amount of time that I, like, not wasted, but spent, and the amount of energy thinking, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. And I look back, and some of the things I'm sort of most proud of were things that I did because I felt they were the right thing to do. And they were the important step to take. And, you know, perceived wisdom would have been, don't do that. But I think you need to, both not just for yourself as an individual, but your organization, you need to kind of have a little bit of faith that you know what you're doing.
Can you dig into that in regards to spare room? Like, was there a time that you had to dig in and kind of double down on something that you can have a little faith?
Yeah, there's a couple of things, really. Like, one of them is just the fact that spare room has no, like, investors. We took no venture capital. We have no shareholders other than people that own the company. And it's been a bit of a struggle at times, but we've built the company by reinvesting money. And, you know, it's not the way you're supposed to do things these days. And it's much easier to take a load of money and spend it really quickly. And it's been an interesting journey, but I think it's been the right course for us. But I think also simple things, like, we have a huge customer service team. Like, you can find our phone number and you can call us, or you can email us. There isn't, like, you can have a chat on the site as well. But if you actually want to talk to a human being to help you, we do that. And it costs us a lot of money, and it's a big investment. And I'm sure we would be more profitable kind of in immediate terms by not doing that. But we still believe that it's a better service and we'll perform better and people will use it more if we try and make it human as well. Because housing and moving, like, we're all sort of slightly in love with real estate, but we all actually hate moving house. And so if we can somehow make people's lives slightly easier while they do that, they will appreciate it. And just having somebody to talk to and answer a question is a really basic, important thing, I think, if you're a business. So many online businesses farm out their customer service to forums and, you know, AI chat, and it doesn't feel right for us.
Do you think that goes to the whole nature of real estate in general, about how it's so emotional, so personal, so intimate? Is that where that drive comes?
I think so. I think it's very emotional, but I think it can also be really highly pressured. Like, I talked before about how people might only need spare room once a year for 2 or 3 weeks. But those 2 or 3 weeks are a pretty frantic 2 or 3 weeks for a lot of people, especially now with a lack of available property and such high prices. And, you know, it's that strange thing of when you live with roommates, not only are you making a financial decision, you're also basically like going on a first date and then you have to move in. And it's, you know, so it's an important time in people's lives. And the more we can do to make that stress-free, the better, I think.
So in terms of stress-free things, one of the ways that we like to see as a stress-free way to get additional knowledge and perspective on the world is through books. And so we ask every single guest that comes on, what's a book that they should pick up?
So this isn't a business book and it's not a real estate book. It's a book called 4,000 Weeks, and it's written by a British journalist called Oliver Berkman. And it's basically a book about time management that isn't about time management. and is a journalist who spent years working on productivity and reading the books and trying all the systems. And he came to the conclusion after a few years that the problem is not we're not productive enough, it's there's just too much to do. And so accepting our limits and accepting the limits of time and actively choosing to not do most things, but do the things that are important, is sort of the main premise of it, really. It's like, you know, you might have a list of 25 priorities and the first three are your top priorities and the others are not priorities at all. And it's extraordinarily liberating and really human way of looking at it and going, it's not my fault that I can't do everything. It's that modern life is way too hectic. So you choose the things that matter to you and you stick with them and you stop worrying about FOMO and stop worrying about the guilt of the 17 things you're not doing at any given, because whatever you're doing, by default, that means you're not doing everything else. And just having it laid out in those terms when I first read it was, and I read it like every 6 months now, I just go back and I underline bits and I go back and just reread them to remind myself, because it just takes a weight off. And it's not taking a weight off in the way of, don't worry, you're not responsible for your life. It's taking a weight off and going, you are, but actually that makes it even more important to choose what matters to you. And I just found it an extraordinary, kind of extraordinary read.
Yeah, that sounds phenomenal. As somebody who's in brokerage and in real estate and development, as well as work with so many people who are, there's always another call you can make. There's always another, there's always another something. And so in terms of that, I think that's a phenomenal read and I'd love to pick it up. But there's one phenomenal thing that we really find about this podcast, and it's that the men and women who are in the arena, they are the best connectors to connect us with the next voice we should have on. And so I'm curious, who should be that next voice?
Well, it's interesting because I'm going to recommend somebody that I haven't actually spoken to, but who I discovered recently. There's a woman called Anna Maria Pluha who runs a website called sharinghousing.com. And she's a passionate advocate of basically taking people in to rent out your spare room. She's been doing it for years. She runs a not-for-profit to encourage other people to do the same. And it just, she's got a book which I've just read, and I'm going to reach out and talk to her at some point, but she just sounds fascinating. Because her experience is over several years of doing this, and I just think she sounds like a really interesting figure.
Yeah, we'd love to have her on. But there's one last question that we'd like to ask you, and it's an important question as well. And it's, Matt, what's the best way to get in touch with you if somebody wants to reach out and they've listened to the podcast? How should they best do that?
They just go to spareroom.com if they want to learn more about Spare Room. If they want to contact me, they can email matt@spareroom.com and that will come through to me. And yeah, it's always great to connect. If people have got things they want to discuss, if people want to talk about some of the things we've covered, I'd love to hear from them.
Matt, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. We have to have you on in the future.
It's been great. Thank you.
Thanks again to Matt. We appreciate his insights. If you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments and interactions and subscriptions truly matter, and they help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear of the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.